Henk, was hältst du davon, wenn wir mal ein bisschen Werbung machen für unseren fantastischen Podcast Was mit Rock und Vinyl?
Ja, aber was willst du denn da sagen?
Na, dass wir ein überragend guter Musikpodcast sind. Wir reden wöchentlich über die wunderbare Welt der Rockmusik, querbeet durch die Jahrzehnte und Musikgenres. Also was meinst du, machen wir einen Spot?
Aber wozu? Wir sind doch so gut. Wir brauchen doch keine Werbung. Was mit Rock und Vinyl?
Überall da, wo gute Podcasts zu Hause sind.
Von 0 auf 100. Aral feiert 100 Jahre mit über 100.000 Gewinnen. Zum Beispiel ein Jahr frei tanken. Jetzt ein Dankeschön rubbellos zu jedem Einkauf. Alle Infos auf aral.de. Aral, alles super.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
Hello dear friends, this is Tom Schulz speaking. Welcome to the Elbphilharmonie Talk. A couple of days ago, a while ago, one of the great tenors of our time, Mr. Brentford Marsalis, performed with his quartet in the Laeishalle, Hamburg. And I had been given the rare opportunity of talking to Brentford in the morning before the concert would take place at that very same day. And he came after 3 years hiatus due to COVID, and everybody knows nobody could travel. So he came with his quartet, consisting of Joey Caltarazzo on piano and Eric Revis on double bass and Justin Faulkner on drums. And I later on went to the concert, and I can only tell you that it was just a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant 2 hours of improvised music, which again proved the extraordinary rank and quality of the Brentford Marsalis Quartet. And in the morning we spoke, you know, about the first tour he was just being on since such a long time, and about the music, about what he had experienced just before he came to Hamburg in Budapest, and Hungarian music. And we spoke about Stravinsky, and we spoke about a lot of exciting things. And he would teach me a thing or two about how different, you know, rhythm can be perceived. And we spoke about Richard Strauss, of course, because, you know, Brentford made a record called Metamorphosen. That couldn't be like an accident. And of course it wasn't. And we spoke about Sting. Yes, about Sting, who he has been performed with, I think, 40 years ago or so. And they still like each other. So just hang on and enjoy the conversation that I had with Brentford Marsalis. Thank you. Good morning, Brentford.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for taking this.
No, it's
taking your time.
It's a pleasure.
I was surprised to learn that you would even have made it at 9 o'clock in the morning. Was that your suggestion?
Yeah.
Are you so early wherever you...
I'm generally an early riser, but yeah, it's worse when I come over here. I usually get up around 5 or 6.
Wow. It is said that the hours between 3 and 6 would be the most productive.
Oh, really? Okay, so we should have done it at 3. That would have been great.
We just had John Thorn here, and he told, you know, he wakes up every night at 3, and then he starts doing all kinds of stuff that right. gets done, like, very efficiently in those 3 hours.
And yeah.
I was wondering. So when did you come to Europe this time?
It's been a couple of weeks now, the 19th of March.
Okay, so this is more than 2 weeks. So are you totally, like, in the climate zone now?
There are a lot of variables. You know, if I go to bed after the concert at a reasonable hour, then I wake up at 4 or 5. But in Budapest, we had a concert where we were playing. I had to write some music based on Hungarian folk melodies, and we hired Hungarian musicians, 5 musicians, to play along with the quartet.
Brilliant.
And we had such a great time, and it was successful, so we stayed up a lot later than we should have. And
celebrating the...
Well, yeah, and then there's an American actor named Wendell Pierce, and we grew up together, and he's doing very well for himself. And he was in Budapest for the last year and a half filming this American television show called Jack Ryan. And mm-hmm. so he was there, and he knows his way around because he's been there for a year and a half, so...
He would show you all the best places.
We stayed up. You know, I have a really good friends from there. This pianist named, you know, Sandor Farkas, and he was a bar piano player at the Grand Hotel for a number of years, and that's where we met, and we stay in touch. So it was a late night.
Beautiful. And what were the other musicians joining you then, the five Hungarian musicians? Him and four others? Or was he not?
Well, it wasn't Sandor, no. Okay. Sandor is 83. Okay. We just talk and drink a lot and argue about opera singers.
Wow.
So, no, it was a singer, Shara Timar was her name, and two wooden flute players, different size instruments, and one guy, Dogo, played flute, and Duda, which is like the Hungarian bagpipes.
Oh.
And the other guy, Shalmon, played flute and accordion, and Bolbe was the terragato player, and a guitar player and two violinists. One played the traditional violin role and the other one played the choro.
Cool. And you wrote all the music for this?
No, I wrote two pieces, but I adapted traditional songs rather than, because, you know, as especially the jazz musicians, we're a strange group of people. We know so much about harmony and so little about jazz. So our inclination was to take a Hungarian melody and add all these new chords. And we think, oh, isn't this great? But if you listen to music and actually listen to it, the chords they use are the perfect chords for the emotional effect that the music intends to have. So we did some jazzy things in the front of the songs, but we always ended up with the traditional sound, which had a really powerful impact, I think, on the listeners, because the jazz things, which are usually foreign to them, suddenly have a different context when the melody that floats over it is their melody and their sound. It was really interesting. We had a good time.
Fantastic. And also you were kind of serving then this music more than taking it as jazz musicians often do, you know, just like,
I've never really, you know. There's an egoism in modern jazz playing that doesn't really serve the music very well. And it's so prevalent that the director of the woman who created the program, she said that she found that I had a lot of humility, which I don't have, but I wrote a six movement piece and I only played in one movement at the end. And she said, you know, most musicians would play and everybody say, yeah, but it seems simple to me. The Hungarian musicians are much better at playing Hungarian music than I will ever be. So if I'm going to write a piece styled on Hungarian music, maybe they should be the ones playing and not me. And even the terragato player, you know, Bolbe, said, are you going to play more? I said, no, you sound great. We don't need a soprano solo and a terragato player. And when this concert is over, like, I'll be in Hamburg and I'll play all the solos. But for this one, I think the terragato is more effective than a soprano saxophone solo. So they all had small solos. And Joey Calderazzo, he played a lot. And Eric and Justin were just playing the traditional role of percussionists.
Supporting. And
it was great. It was great. The Shalmon, the flute and accordion player, brought a percussion instrument that's very popular in folk music, and it is the shape of a cello with a flat back and four strings.
Wow.
And you tune it to D, and you just hit it with a stick. And it creates a very unique sound. So Justin played that on two of the songs. We had a good time.
And you were basically standing on stage and just enjoying yourself and watching these people and listening to their music.
That's what I was doing. There were times when I conducted because it was necessary, but when I was finished, I would move to the side and let them do it.
And that gave the image of Branford being very humble and
I don't know.
Serving.
I never thought about it that way. I thought I was being practical.
Yeah.
If the musicians are really good, and they're all chamber players, they play folk music, we play in a quartet. No one conducts chamber music, really, with nine people.
Why would you? Yeah.
So what would I be standing there for? So start the song and then let the audience see the people playing.
And what's so great with these Hungarian musicians is also that in their written music, you know, that seamlessly goes into the folk.
Right.
And vice versa. You know, we had this Hungarian orchestra in the Elbphilharmonie, which you know very mm-hmm. well, and they brought this choir, this women's choir.
Right.
And they were just positioned all across the orchestra,
mm-hmm.
and they were doing a cappella things, and it was goosebumpy kind of stuff, you know.
It's a beautiful music culture. They all have great rhythm. Oh, my God, the rhythm is so...
And all these odd meters, and it all flows, and it has such passion. And
It took me... I figured this out a while ago, listening to... Romanian music, and I talked to a Romanian musician, and his English wasn't great, and I said something like, how do you guys play those odd meters? And he said, well, what are you talking about? And I said, well, these songs are in complicated meters. He said, well, not to us. They don't learn meter. They just learn it.
Yeah.
They learn it when they're little, and they just sing it. So that's why it sounds so natural, because they're not counting it. They can hear it.
Yeah.
And it kind of helped me in playing odd meter. It's like, I have to learn how to hear that as just normal.
So
because if I think of it as odd,
then
I'm always kind of making a written solo to make sure that it all ties together. But if I can just feel the beat, then it's not odd anymore. It's just 1-1.
And is this coming basically via the melody, or what makes it easier to feel it?
Sometimes it's via the melody. A lot of these songs have bass lines that are very repetitive.
Mm-hmm.
And when the bass players are playing it well, they have a lot of discipline, so they play the same part so everyone can know what's going on. So depending on the song, I'll follow the melody or I'll follow the bass line. And some, I just have to listen to it long enough until my mind grabs it and says, oh, okay, that's what that is.
And then it totally opens up and then you don't have to think about it anymore.
Right.
I'm impressed and surprised, because I would have thought that a musician of your expertise and knowledge and lifelong practice would just easily keep up with any odd meter and you know.
I don't have a problem with odd meter songs now. But when I did, that was the process that I used.
Yeah.
I just listened to the music until it's no longer odd. Yeah. It starts to just make perfect sense.
That makes much sense.
Yeah, it's just, you know, so Stravinsky in his autobiography would always talk about to understand his music, it is required that the listeners listen with other ears, he would call it, which probably gets lost in English translation. But after he wrote it enough times, I started to realize what he meant. It's like we all grow up with a certain idea of whatever convention is. Like we have this conventional way of listening. And we have this image of breaking free of these things. When you don't break free of them, you just kind of outgrow them. You just add other things.
Mm-hmm.
Because the convention is always there. It's never gone. You're never going to get to a place where you're playing music and you forget how to play in 4-4. I mean, of course, you're never going to, in American music, 4-4 is the basis of the music. You're never going to forget.
Yeah.
But then you learn how to add other things to it. You add other sounds. You add other ideas. And I've always tried to, as I've aged, treat them all as the same kind of thing. Because at the end of the day, the power in music, regardless of the genre, is its ability to create an emotional effect on the listener. That's more important than anything else. That's what people walk away with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, happy music sounds happy, sad music sounds sad, angry music should sound angry. It should not just be, wow, these guys play really complicated pieces.
We are impressed with the complications.
Wow, that's when you realize most of your audience is musicians, because they're the only people who can understand why the music is even worthy of consideration.
Yeah.
So no matter how complicated the piece is, we try to create a color or a sound that a regular listener can hold on to. So they don't need to know the information. It's our job to make that part easy for them.
It's rather maybe the musician's job to kind of veil the intricacies and complications of a certain piece. Well, like, you know, with Stravinsky, I mean, of course you need the convention, because otherwise you wouldn't cherish the deviation of the convention.
Well, the thing about Stravinsky's music that's very interesting to me, and always has been when I really didn't know what it was, is that no matter how complicated it is, there's always a melody. And since there's always a melody and it's always singable, you always know where it is. You can sing along with it. A lot of modern contemporary music, you can't sing along with it.
No way.
And that's the thrill of being a musician, but it's also a disadvantage because there's nothing for the audience to hold on to. And like a guy like Stravinsky or a guy like... I'm looking right at his music. Viola player who wrote really...
Bartok?
No, German.
Hindemith.
Yes, Hindemith, thank
Paul
you.
Paul Hindemith,
yes.
Yeah.
Man, there's always melodies there.
Yeah, it's
I
true.
Mean, I was playing this piece that he wrote for tenor saxophone, viola, or heckelphone, but mm-hmm. tenor saxophone, viola, and piano. And in the middle of the third movement, I got lost. I miscounted. And I waited, and all I did, I heard the viola part, and then suddenly I knew exactly where I was. And then I started playing, and, you know, the musicians, man, how did you do that? I said, he writes melodies. There are always melodies. Even the piano part is melodic. If the other things were missing, and you hear the piano going, it's just very melodic. It all makes melodic sense. A lot of modern music does not. And that can be thrilling on one hand, but I can understand why it would be very frustrating for listeners, because you have to give them something to hang on to.
Yeah. It's another brain area sometimes approached or called upon, you know,
right.
when it's about this music.
Right.
Branford, I mean, we're hopefully kind of exiting these 2 years of pandemic, and I wonder how was that for you? I mean, did you stay in, you lived in New York City before or close to New York City? Or
no, I live about 800 kilometers south of New York City in North Carolina. I enjoyed it. I had a great time. I didn't miss traveling, but I did miss playing, and I especially miss playing with my guys. So we would talk on Zoom a couple of times a month. And Joey, we live in the same town, so I would see Joey.
Oh, okay.
And it was great. This is the most time that my kids will ever spend with me in their lives. So a year and a half uninterrupted. That was pretty cool for them. They got to know me in a different way, other than the guy who shows up for 2 weeks and then leaves for six and comes back. And
yeah,
you know, and that part was really good.
And it was also rewarding for you, I guess. Not only for them, or were you anxious and uncertain? And
I wasn't uncertain. And I'm not an anxious person. I just made a list of really difficult pieces that I wanted to learn, that I've always wanted to learn and didn't have time to learn. And I learned three of those pieces. And I listened to a lot of music from the 20s and 30s because that was a weak spot for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I continued to listen to a lot of 20s music and 30s music and played the saxophone a little bit, but practiced a lot. The way normal people practice, you know, two practice sessions a day, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, not showing up at the venue 4 hours before the concert and sneaking in 2 hours, which is what I usually have to do.
Okay.
So I enjoyed most aspects of it, and I had a chance to, you know, stop and reflect on my life and reflect on who I am and what I wanted to be and make necessary changes. And it was, I think overall it was good for me.
Great. Because, I mean, many musicians really had a hard time, you know, keeping themselves motivated, keeping their chops, you know.
Yeah, I think that if you watch television shows, you know, television shows are filled with stereotypes, and the stereotypes are rooted in a sort of truth. there are a lot of musicians who identify as musicians, but I've always identified as a person first and a musician second. To me, I'm no different than a carpenter or an insurance salesman. That's what I do for a living. Now, it requires a different set of skills, and you have to practice longer, but the challenge of, that's why I challenge myself with playing difficult pieces. But I think if you were in a kind of band where you've developed your own style and you know what your style is and your songs tend to be very repetitive, yeah, I could see why you would struggle, because your inclination is not to practice because you have this style, and this style has made you successful or made you famous. And you know, the whole music scene, hanging out with musicians till 2-3 in the morning and that whole thing, I mean, yeah, people miss that. I haven't done that in decades. You know, once I left New York, I realized, like, there's no musicians hanging out in clubs in North Carolina. You know, because, well, there are, but the clubs close at 12:30.
Okay, so that's not
true. And everyone goes home.
Yeah.
And so it's a very, very different atmosphere. And I've been there for 20 years. And I grew up that way. Even though in New Orleans, the musicians stay up. You can stay up really late there. You can stay up all night there. But the musicians had a certain, musicians, they have a bond that I haven't really found anywhere else. They just, you know, love and support one another, and they don't get bogged down by petty jealousies. You know, they're not, so if I'm playing somewhere and a friend of mine or a colleague of mine is playing later, then so you always say, well, you know, the party's not over, folks. It's over there, and let's go over there and support that guy.
Cool.
You know, and then when I got to New York, the experience was very different, because the musicians tended to be rather fragile personally. So they always thought that every new person was the person that was going to take their jobs. So the relationship was different.
A threat, kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And the reality is that you can only control what you can control. If a person's coming to take my job, then they'll take it, or they won't. But the only thing I can control is practicing and getting better, and they might know things that I don't know, so I'll hang out with them and see what they're talking about and learn things from them. I mean, that's the way I kind of grew up.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, the pandemic was fine for me. I wrote a couple of, I wrote a score for a documentary, and it got an Emmy nomination. That was cute. That was nice.
Beautiful.
But I used my time wisely and tried to spend a lot of time with my kids, because they're almost all grown up. And
yeah, and time flies, you know, and then they're gone.
Totally, yeah.
And
yes.
And you haven't seen much of them.
Yes.
Yeah. But then, I mean, you've already mentioned it, you know, you missed most of all, you missed playing with your guys,
yeah,
with your band.
Yeah.
Getting together again, I mean, did you have to rehearse at all, or would you just...
I don't believe in rehearsal.
Oh.
So no, we didn't rehearse. Because, I mean, we're playing songs, we're not playing concertos. Concertos, you have to rehearse. Or the music we just did with the Hungarians, yes, you have to rehearse,
yeah,
that. We're all meeting for the first time. The guys in the band are playing music they're not familiar with. The Hungarians are hearing their songs interpreted in a way that's not familiar with them. It's like this really funny thing. I can explain it because we're on you know, it's a radio show, but I can explain it.
Yeah.
In one of the songs, it's a folk song called It's Raining. So when I wrote the arrangement, I heard it in this beat. So I said to the bass line would just go bing, 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 bing. And then the chords would float around it, and the woman would sing above it. But when they're playing the song, this is the beat they hear.
I'm punctuated already.
But I'm hearing. So it was a matter of them.
Time feels very different.
They're saying, can we play it fast? I said, we can try, but you're going to have to get used to hearing it in our space. Because we could do it in your space, but then the whole point of the thing was that everybody has to learn something and give up something. And they said, yeah, okay. So it took 2 days, and then they figured it out. But it blew our minds when we realized that they're counting it. And I said, well, why do you count it that way? He says, because that's the dance step. when we play the song, this is the way they dance.
That's the way they put their steps.
And I said, oh, that's amazing. So, you know, I said, man, always put that beat in the back of your mind so the music can kind of be in two places at one time.
Which is fabulous. You know, Cuban and, kind of polyrhythmic.
Yeah, it was great. Fantastic. So yeah, that's what I mean. It's like, so other than that, with our group, we don't practice. If we have to learn a new song, we'll learn it. But I really want it to be improvisatory. I want it to be to have the sound of freedom, not the sound of control. Because a lot of the modern music I hear, the structures are very controlled. Everything is in a box. So all the solos, they feel vertical to me. Mm-hmm. Like they're correct and they go up and down. But if you listen to music from the 20s, 30s, and 40s, they feel like they have forward motion, like they have propulsion. And all the music I like, whether it's folk music, classical music, the great stuff always has a sense of propulsion. And each composer finds a different instrument or a different way to create that energy. And a lot of the modern music, it's played very light, so it doesn't have the dance beat at all. And the solos are really fast, and they kind of float, and they play in between. They use quarter note triplets or eighth note triplets to get to the fast part and then back to the slow part. And it just doesn't have a sense of propulsion at all. Yeah. So I try to avoid writing songs like that will put us in that box. And I really want us to go on stage and with the idea that anything can happen. So the songs can really be different from night to night. Whereas if you practice them, then you start to learn a certain kind of pattern, call and response. Well, these licks were good on this song. These licks were good on that song. So from night to night, the tempo changes, the mood of the piece changes. And so they're by definition, they're different.
And that also applies to the set list?
There is no set list.
There is no set list.
Yeah, we call out a couple of songs. I'll call out the first three songs. And then everything else is subject to the energy from the audience and how we feel.
And is there sometimes a moment where you say, well, now I want to change the direction, of course, and yeah. I want to go someplace else?
It happens all the time, based on the energy of the room. And we make these kind of game time decisions.
And the part of the magic of a quartet or of any band, for that matter, is probably that they kind of collectively follow this and direct follow this thread of improvisation.
Well, I think that the strength of the group is that we've gotten away from the idea that every solo is my turn to shine. And the solo is just a part of the conversation. It's like four people sitting in the pub drinking beers and talking about their favorite football team. And they say, well, this is my favorite part of the game. And then the other person says, well, this is my favorite part of the game. The person talking doesn't think like I'm on a stage and this is my time. It's like enhancing the conversation, and it's all part of the same conversation. In each song, we all have a part in the conversation, and the solos are just part of the general discussion. And I think that's the thing that I love about playing with them, is that all of the music is conversational. It's not so scripted and prepared. Well, you know, I'm going to have my solo and I'm going to play, and it doesn't matter what you play, I'm going to play these things. It really feels spontaneous, and I like that.
And it still reminds me of the nice definition of the string quartet, you know, being like a conversation between four very elaborate people or whatever.
Well,
you know,
Esa-Pekka Salonen came to a concert in San Francisco and gave me the greatest compliment. Well, gave us, but he was talking to me. He says, the thing that's most amazing is like listening to your band. You guys really aren't a jazz band at all. You're a chamber group.
See?
And I went, wow, thank you, man. That was really nice.
Yeah. And that applies to everything. That also applies to dynamics, of course, and to,
of course.
To the...
I mean, you want to be a part of the group that transcends all of these definitions. But the only way to do that is to understand all the standard definitions. Like once we all learned that jazz used to be a dance music and that we had to learn the dance beat, because the dance beat is the swing beat, not the accent on two and four. The accent on two and four is a byproduct of the dance beat.
It's definitely not the legs.
You know, it's not like, okay, as long as you're playing, it's going to be swinging. It's not. It's just going to be beats on two and four. Mm-hmm. The swing is this kind of, It's like the Hungarian music. When it has this swing, it's this thing in the air. It's the same thing. You know, like we go ding, 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 ding. And it's that beat, this 4-4 beat, is the way that the drummers played in the late 20s and the 30s. And then in the 40s, they stopped playing that way, and it got softer and softer. So what you had is the bass player walking the bass line and the drummer using the bass drum to prop up the bass sound. Because the basses in the 20s and 30s were just going boom, 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 boom. Suddenly just like ding, 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 ding. So modern drummers, because they don't hear the bass drum playing on all four beats,
yeah,
they just stop doing it completely. So the whole essence of the dance beat disappears and the music becomes this other thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we can argue about whether that's better or for worse. That's not really important to me. What's important is that it's another thing. It's not the thing. And we all decided we wanted to be a part of the thing. So we learned standard jazz traditions and then learned how to apply them to our own music. So we're we're perpetually learning and we're always students. I don't think of myself as an innovator. I don't even want to be an innovator. I'm more interested in being competent. Being a good musician is more important to me than inventing something, which is kind of crazy anyway, because it's a 12-note system. And I guess nobody's really invented the 13th note in Western music, at least.
Not yet, unless it's microtonal stuff.
Yeah, but then it's just, so the only innovations in music come through sound. When you think about it, I mean, like I sat in class in 1975 and Dr. Bro was saying, you know, Beethoven changed the game, and he puts the score on the board and says, here's why. He was the first person to use a major seventh chord. He was the first person to do this. No one had done that. And the answer, as I've gotten older, is really simple. Beethoven changed the game because he felt that unlike his predecessors, unlike Mozart and
Haydn.
Johann Strauss and Handel, who was his man, he felt that orchestras should be louder and higher. So he has more basses, more cellos, more instruments, and suddenly he's using piccolos. No one's using piccolos in classical music. And they said, this is monstrosity. This is awful. What is he doing? Oh, it's because he's going deaf. It's crazy. And now when you look at a standard orchestra, the standard orchestra is essentially the Beethoven orchestra. So yeah, he changed the game. It had nothing to do with the stuff on the page. You know, it had nothing to do with, I'm going to invent the major seventh chord. No, that was the sound he needed to make that part in the third movement, in the second movement work. I mean, it was simple. All these answers are much simpler than we try to make them.
And I would argue that he was the first to use the major seventh chord. I mean,
in Western music.
Yeah.
Fine. You know, but everybody that teaches, whatever you teach, that's the most important thing in the world.
Really?
Like the jazz instructors always say, this is the first, Bill Evans was the first person to use a sharp five chord. And I say, well, you know, Richard Strauss did it in 1890. What? But they never heard Richard Strauss.
Yeah.
So they said, well, in jazz, like, so this is a separate kingdom. And our kingdom, this guy's the first. But I stopped thinking about music in those terms a long time ago. To me, it's all just sound.
Speaking of Richard Strauss, I mean, there's this record of yours, Metamorphosen.
Yeah.
And of course, Strauss is the guy, and I'm sure you had him in mind in some
way.
That's
where I got the name from.
Yeah. Like that piece?
I love Strauss. I mean, the way he hears music still shocks me today. Mm-hmm. I can't believe, like, his approach to structure and resolution is just, I still don't know how he did it. I don't know how he does it. I mean, I can listen to anything. You know, you listen to DeRozan Cavalier, and how do you get from this point to this point? You know, it's almost like, you know.
Quite breathtaking.
Uh-oh, there's no way he's going to get there. Oh, God, how did he do that?
Yeah.
It's like, and I don't do that with a lot of musicians. I mean, Stravinsky is one. Like, I can't even believe this stuff is possible. But I love Strauss. I mean, I could listen to him. I do. Ariadne off Naxos, and, you know.
How about Vier Letzte Lieder? Like these songs.
The four last songs. Yeah, incredible.
That's
incredible.
magnificent, I find.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he was the last aria at the end of Der Rosenkavalier, the one that they sang at his funeral.
Mm-hmm.
What can you say? I mean, it's just perfection.
Yeah. So when you are going on stage tonight, no set list, no, just the first three songs, you say.
Yeah.
Will those be songs from the last album, or is even that up in the air? Did you know it right now in the morning? Or
no, there won't be. One of them, maybe two, would be. You know, we alternate. Like the second slot is usually like either like Joey's ballad or something completely different. Completely.
Mm-hmm.
Completely different. And lately we've been starting out with this Thelonious Monk song, Tio, which is a song that we recorded in 2007.
Oh, cool.
But we play it a lot better now than we did then. And then other nights we'll start out with a Joey song, The Mighty Sword. Sometimes we'll start out with a standard. It just depends on the audience in the room and how we're feeling. We played a set in Brussels where we played really heavy, hard, modern music, and everybody liked it, and we could feel the energy in the room. And it was I had already played. I had this. I agreed to play a solo concert on a Wednesday, a concert with the Belgian National Orchestra on Thursday, and then the quartet on Friday. And one of the pieces we played was this John Williams piece, Escapades, that has a trio in the front of a vibraphone, saxophone, and bass. So Eric played the bass part, and we were all pretty mentally taxed. And then we get to Katowice, and I'm like, man, I don't have that kind of energy tonight. So we played a completely different set with more standards and more things, and the audience really loved it. They liked it. So it just depends on a lot of
factors. On the circumstances and what was before.
Yeah,
and
I didn't have the physical or the mental energy to play the set we played in Brussels.
Yeah.
You know, so that's how I know I'm getting old. When I was in my 40s, I mean, I'm just, yeah, we do this every night. Let's just go for it. But now, yeah, 61, it's different. So, yeah, it just depends. It just depends with what the room sounds like. I mean, we haven't played this room in a long time. So when we get out there, the room will kind of dictate which styles we play. And
yeah, yeah.
I mean, I always love playing in Germany because the audiences are so smart, you know, listening-wise. They can hear the music. They hear what we're doing.
Yeah.
And I can feel that they emotionally understand what we're trying to accomplish. So it's fun to play for audiences in Germany.
That's beautiful.
It's easy, too.
Yeah. I always feel, you know, they're willing to get very close.
Yeah,
and
you know, they're really paying attention.
So there is an osmosis taking place.
Yeah.
How is it with the solo concerts and solo playing? Have you been doing that?
I had actually forgotten about that.
Really?
Because the concert was 2 years ago and it got canceled.
Yeah.
In COVID. And the week before, I was talking to my agent and said, well, you know, I got to really practice this classical stuff. And then it's great because then it's over because then I can focus on the band and I'm scoring a film. And I said, and she goes, no, what about the solo concert? And I went, oh my God, no. So I keep all of that music. Fortunately, I keep it on the cloud. So I downloaded the music. Some things were missing. And then when I got to the church, the delay in the church was almost 15 seconds. So suddenly there's just a lot of things you can't play.
No.
And I sent my road manager to the back. I sent Rod to the back. I said, I'm going to start playing. Tell me what you hear. He says, it's just a big pile of mush. You can't. So suddenly I have to play songs where everything is slow. Everything is arpeggiation. You know, going bah, 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 bah. Instead of bah, playing those chromatics.
Fitting together. Yeah,
you have to keep the spaces open and play solos that are basically all like 20 style, all arpeggios.
Yeah.
Which is fine. It's another challenge. You know, great. We can do that. So it was a very different show. It was more mentally difficult because I ran out of material after the third or fourth song, and I just had to invent things, that find standards that I think would work in that space and take my time. And it was, I think I pulled it off. But I hadn't done one of those in at least 2 years. So it was mentally, I woke up the next day and I was really tired. And again, great, now I have rehearsal this morning.
Classical stuff.
And then, now we're going to play the Villa-Lobos piece and, you know, and the John Williams piece.
Yeah. Are you more critical with yourself when you have played solo or when you are playing solo? Or is that not a category?
I'm critical with myself in general. The classical music, it's tricky because you can get bogged down on being critical of the notes that you miss. But I really do try to focus on whether I'm emotionally present when I'm playing the piece. Because that's ultimately what audiences will respond to. There'll always be a couple of saxophone players sitting in there with scores, reading, looking for mistakes, and you can't control that. But I think the audience in general, they come to concerts to enjoy it. And it's something that I noticed in operas when you have sopranos that have to hit high Cs. There's some that can hit a high C and stay in character. And there's some where they lose the character because their whole body, they're like everything is riding on this high C. So their body tenses up and they get rigid and then they belt out the C. And
if then even the C isn't really beautiful because it's
because it has to be correct. It's like in it. And again, that's an acquired, I mean, I know what that feels like. That's an acquired skill. You have to become more comfortable with yourself, comfortable with your voice. But it's a very different thing when they just open their mouth and the sea comes out and they just keep going and it has an ease and audiences will totally respond to that.
One probably silly question. I was listening again to some of your music yesterday and of course I also came across this old Sting record, the first one that you did with him. And I saw, I mean, Spotify, 225 million listens to
Dream of the Blue Turtles, great record.
Dream of the, exactly. Great and record. That song, the Englishman in Paris.
The Englishman in New York.
In New York nice. And it really lives so much with your soprano. And I was listening to it again, and I wonder, for one, are you still in touch with Sting every now and then?
I just saw him.
Oh, nice.
He wrote some lyrics for me for. The character, the main character in the movie I was writing was a lawyer who, in his spare time, sang Elizabethan songs and played the lute.
Which is very fitting for Sting, of course.
And the director wanted an original song instead of a traditional song. And I said, great, I'll do it. So I wrote this song, and Sting heard it and said, man, this is really pretty. I said, yeah, I need you to write some lyrics for this. And he did in old English style, and it worked out well. It worked out well. And he played a concert in Greensboro, North Carolina that was canceled during the pandemic. So I got to see him and he got to meet my kids.
Oh, nice.
And that part was great because they know about him and they talk about him and tease me about playing with him. And so they got to meet him and they were like, man, he's really cool. I'm like, yeah, he's been cool for a long time.
Yeah.
It was a great time. I mean, when you're 25, you take that stuff for granted. You're not thinking, savor these moments. You're 25. You don't savor anything. You just, this is fun. This is great.
Yeah.
And then it's over and you say, all right, man, next time. You know, and then 30 years later, you're like, oh, wait, there is no next.
Yeah. And then this conversation just ended abruptly in the middle of that sentence. There is no next time. That's what he wanted to say. And he didn't say much more because we were pretty much done with our conversation. But this nice little recorder, the new one that I got, just died. You know, the battery was gone. And I'm so lucky that it only vanished just at the end of our conversation, which I hope you enjoyed listening to. Thank you so much.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
Von 0 auf 100. Aral feiert 100 Jahre mit über 100.000 Gewinnen. Zum Beispiel ein Jahr frei tanken. Jetzt ein Dankeschön, rubbellos zu jedem Einkauf. Alle Infos auf aral.de. Aral, alles super.
Ich habe mich natürlich schockverliebt, weil die war wirklich ganz, ganz klein.
So begann die Mensch-Hund-Beziehung zwischen Christina und Tierschutzhund Frieda. Und wie es danach, nach dem ersten Moment der Verliebtheit, so weiterging und welche Klippen es danach zu umschiffen galt, das hört ihr in der neuen Ausgabe von Iswas Dog, dem Podcast für harmonische Mensch-Hund-Beziehungen.
Iswas Dog mit Malte Asmus.
überall, wo es Podcasts gibt.